I know that neither of us are anthropologists, neuroscientists, or evolutionary biologists, but what we're going to talk about tonight is the architecture of thought and whether the architecture of thought requires spatial awareness to function. Sound exciting?
Whoa.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah, you weren't kidding.
So the idea from this, just to give credit, the idea from this offshoots from Michael Bond's book, From Here to There, The Art and Science of Finding and Losing Our Way. A good percentage of what I'm going to tell you about is my extrapolations from little pieces from his book, but his book was the starting place for that. So one of the things that he says in the book is he talks about Howard Eichenbaum, who actually was a neuroscientist, or is, I think Eichenbaum's still alive. Howard Eichenbaum believed that our abilities for autobiographical memory and imagination may actually be built upon the hippocampus's spatial structures, that what we refer to as mental maps may literally be maps in our mind. Does that make sense? Or is that still too abstract and high level?
No, that totally makes sense.
Okay. So what I thought when I read this, that's the part from the book, what I immediately thought of when he says that we've built everything in our brain with the foundation of spatial awareness underneath everything, it made me think of memory palaces. Are you aware of memory palaces?
Yeah, we've talked about them at some point. I mean, it's been a long time since I touched on the idea of them, but I definitely remember them for sure.
Maybe that's why memory palaces work. That we can say, I'm putting this thought here, this thought here, this thought here, this thought here, and then we can virtually walk through the memory palace. I mean, this is memory palace. I don't know if you've ever read Moonwalking with Einstein?
No.
The author, Jonah Foer, goes to the United States Memory Championship and talks to the people who are these memory champions. And then he ends up competing himself. And one of the things that he learns is the most powerful tool for these people is the memory palace. And the stuff that they're able to remember is like 300 digits of pi using a memory palace.
Do you remember the origin of our conversation on memory palaces?
I do not.
It was our conversation about Sherlock, because he uses memory palaces in the show, and they had like a physical
representation
of it. Yeah,
yeah, where he has the stuff floating through the air. It's not specifically a memory palace, but similar idea.
Yeah,
the memory palace is actually a physical place that you're remembering.
But do you remember the episode? Was it Moriarty? It was one of the last episodes in the series, and part of it takes place in a memory palace.
Oh, is that part of season 3 when he's breaking him out?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. It's been a while. I need to go back and watch all those. Okay, so if maps are important, if we're building our thoughts upon the structure of maps, then it makes sense that using a map to remember things would be useful, right? That seems pretty straightforward.
Sure.
So what I'm wondering is, Are you familiar with the experience of consolidating your memories around a location? For example, say there's a park that you've been to 5 times, but you don't really remember it as 5 times. To you, they all seem like it happened on the same day.
I'm trying to think if I've actually had that tangible experience. I don't know if I have.
Or think of a place that you've been to many times, like your work. Mm-hmm. Do you ever mash up days? Like, oh yeah, that's right. Those were 2 different days. That's right.
Yeah, that occasionally happens, sure.
What's taking place there is we're using these things that are called place cells. They encode memories to a location. They function similarly to what we've talked about before, about how we can overwrite over the same synapse and how that consolidates things because they're connecting over the same synapse. Mm-hmm. That's how our memories get messed up. And every time something goes over the same synapse, those things are fused together, and then they start to seem like reality. They start to seem like they belong together, even though they were separate.
Because they take place in the same environment and have the same rough conditions?
In the case of place cells. When we're talking with synapses, it doesn't necessarily have to do with locations. You know, for example, you could remember facts about one person and confuse them with facts of another person because for some reason the synapses of those 2 people were overlaid in your brain.
Okay, I see what you mean.
So it's very similar. I'm not really sure how place cells are different. And it may just be a conceptual idea that they use to explain this phenomena. I brought that up because it's another connection between place and the function of the brain, just to kind of reinforce what he's saying about spatial awareness being the underlying structure, the operating system, which we built everything in our mind on top of. Mm-hmm. So it got me thinking about travel. It's always been advised for people, if they want to expand their mind, to travel the globe. And much of the reason that we've always associated that this is beneficial, that people become more intelligent and more open with their minds, is because they're experiencing different cultures and different people and different ways of life. But what I wonder is there a second part to that? Is there also a benefit to it because we are adding more maps into our mind? Hmm. So if we build things upon the structure of maps, does our brain function better the more maps that we give it?
Interesting.
And that could be a reason why that happens. So what I thought was, okay, well, what about the reverse? We're all experiencing the opposite right now. We're all experiencing less maps being fed into our machines. We're seeing the same thing over and over again. So that got me thinking about solitary confinement. When people are put into solitary confinement, what happens to them? What happens to the function of someone's brain when they're deprived of maps and they're deprived of using the spatial part of their brain? Mm. And what we find out is that solitary confinement actually permanently damages people's brains. It's one of the reasons that they're trying to outlaw solitary confinement.
Interesting.
Yeah, it completely destroys their brain. Do you know who Damien Eccles is?
That name sounds familiar.
You know the West Memphis Three?
Yeah.
He was one of the West Memphis Three. And in the time that he was falsely imprisoned, he spent a lot of time in solitary. And if you watch his YouTube and stuff like that, he'll tell you his brain is broken. Mm. Like there's just certain things he can't remember. Like his memory is messed up from that time in solitary confinement.
It's interesting because, I'm just chewing on this idea in my head because I'm trying to, you know, obviously when we talk about things like this, the first thing I try to do is I ask my own question with my own life in mind, saying like, okay, well, has that had a tangible effect on my memory? You know, like I traveled 3 continents by the time I was 18. Mm-hmm. And since then I've traveled quite a bit. And I have a weirdly good long-term memory. Mm-hmm. Like I have an excellent memory for like writing and movies and basically most artistic things, most creative things actually. And I actually have a pretty good memory for other things in general, but I think because I enjoy creative things, I lock them away, but I have a space by which to do so.
Not only do they lose certain mental functions, they also lose the ability to form social maps. And they have trouble reintegrating into society. Do you remember Shawshank Redemption? Mm-hmm. Remember Brooks Hatlin, the librarian?
Yeah, I do.
He gets released and he hangs himself because he's unable to build a new life. It's clear to me that depriving people of the ability to feed things into the social mapping part of our brain, to the hippocampus, it does cause some sort of damage. And it makes me think of cabin fever. Is cabin fever as psychological as we think it is? Or are we reacting to some physical phenomena happening in the brain because we're confined to one location and the brain starts misfiring because it's not being fed all of the stuff that it needs to be fed? So I wonder if people like introverts like myself, whether we just have a higher tolerance or whether we're supplanting the need for this continual mapping input, spatial input in some other way. Do we just have better imaginations so we can build imaginary structures?
If traveling meant better memory and not traveling meant worse memory, then it would be such a one-to-one relationship that you would assume that people who never traveled would have terrible memories, right? But in your case, and I think in the case of a lot of people, I definitely do think that there's a creative component there too. Like if you can create worlds in your own head and you can build the rooms yourself, then I think there's definitely a component of that internally that allows you to build those structures for yourself. Like with me, for example, I think the reason why my short-term memory is okay. My long-term memory is phenomenal. But I think it's because I had the combination of those things. Not only did I get to travel, but I also have a pretty vivid imagination too. You know what I mean?
All brains are different in their own way. You know, like just,
sure.
I don't mean just in the individual way, but I mean in the biological structure way. You know, like some people have larger hippocampus, some people have, mm-hmm. you know, larger prefrontal cortex. It's just genetics or whatever, mostly genetics, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you look at introversion or extroversion, it kind of tends to run in families. And I don't think it's necessarily learned behavior because I didn't grow up around introverts.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting to think that, you know, not only our spatial structures and our spatial input, but the social maps that we build can also be reliant or supplanted to some degree by creativity. Because I think about myself, and oftentimes I'm having conversations in my head, not with myself, but you know, mm-hmm. like imaginary conversations with other people.
Sure.
You know, I'm not deluded and think I'm actually talking to them. I'm not saying that. You know, like something strange habit that I picked up is that sometimes I'm being interviewed, or I'm interviewing someone.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm having that conversation in my head. So I wonder if that also, you know, like if, I think that would probably be a common trait among introverts, that introverts probably have more conversations in their head than extroverts do. So maybe that could also be part of that resistance, I guess, to the mental degrade. Now, yeah. I definitely know that if they stuck me in solitary confinement, I would be okay at first, but I would fall apart eventually too.
Yeah, well, I mean, the social component to human society and humanity as a whole, I definitely think there's a biological component to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like there must be. Like we're social creatures by nature, and the thriving of our species has 100% relied upon our ability to socially gather and problem solve.
Before I got the dog, when I first started going for my walks every day,
mm-hmm. yeah,
I'm sure you remember at the time you and I had conversations about how much walking was changing my world.
Sure.
And it was literally this process of just looking at things that I hadn't seen before. And somehow it was doing something to my brain. I think what it was doing is exactly what we're talking about here. It was expanding my brain in a way that hadn't been opened in a while.
Mm.
And I started to find myself not only in a better mental place cognitively, but also in a better mental place psychologically.
Mm.
And I, at the time, I attributed it to the endorphins from the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I think about it more, over time, I don't think that release was happening. I used to get to a point because I was, you know, not used to walking very long distances. I would get to about a half hour and I could actually feel that process happen. Like the dopamine would hit me, but that went away. My body started being conditioned for walking every day. That moment didn't happen anymore. It went away.
Wow, so weird.
But the cognitive benefits remained. So that would mean to me that those two things were not related.
You don't think there's still a correlation there?
No, I don't. Because if I they can't be. If I'm no longer getting one, but I'm still getting the other, then they can't be related.
Yeah, that's true. Or maybe, well, no, that's not necessarily true.
They're correlated, but they're not causated. You know, they're not connected causally.
Yeah, yeah. But maybe you're taking time out of the equation, right? Like maybe it needed to be kickstarted somehow, and maybe it's not a gradual process, but a chaotic one. And if it's a chaotic one, then every once in a while you receive the right stimulus at the right time, and it pushes it forward.
To be honest, I don't think that they're related in any way. I think that they just happen parallel. And I really think what it is the input of spatial awareness. If I go for a walk, I have this habit, you know, the dog is short, so I keep an eye on him.
Mm-hmm.
I end up in this habit where I realize I've been walking, looking at my feet in the sidewalk. And I haven't been looking around. And whenever I catch myself in that, I'm usually not enjoying myself. But when I lift my head and I start looking around and paying attention to the trees, the sky, the cars, the houses, you know, the grass, the lights on this house, what's that house numbered? When I start paying attention to that stuff, I start enjoying the walk.
Wow, weird.
It makes sense. Solitary confinement, right? What's happening in solitary confinement? Nothing.
Yeah, true.
You're getting no input. So what's happening? You think about, why do they say sitting is the new smoking? Because the moment you sit down for a few minutes, your body actually starts breaking down. So your cells actually need to be active.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to civilization, what were humans doing? Moving all day. They didn't have couches. They didn't have chairs. They were moving all day. They're hunting, hiding from other animals, you know, whatever, chasing each other, screwing in the bushes. They were consistently moving. So why would our body be, I mean, our mind be any different than our body? If you're not getting input into the brain, it makes sense that it would begin to break down, that it would begin to work less efficiently.
Yeah, that makes sense.
What it also made me think of is when therapists, one of the things therapists love to recommend, oh, you're feeling depressed? Go for a walk.
Sure.
And yes, they might be trying to trigger that endorphin and that dopamine hit, but by expanding the maps in our mind, they're also breaking out that, you know, because depression and things, anxiety, things like that, they're ruts.
Mm-hmm.
They're a cycle. You're broken in the cycle. So it's like being in solitary confinement. You're just repeating the small thing in front of you. You know, it's like us just scanning to the left of the room, scanning to the right of the room. What else do you have to look at? That's it. And depression is kind of the same way, because depression turns you internally and you spin mm-hmm. tighter and tighter in the circles. Same with anxiety. But when you are adding things to your mind, it's expanding. So obviously it would break you out of that from a both figurative sense and I think actually in a physiological sense.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of Stephen King's book, Dead Zone. You remember that?
Yeah, I do.
The whole premise of the book is the reason that his brain starts working the way it is because he had damage in that part of the brain and
yeah.
the brain rewires around it.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what our brain is doing if we're not getting enough input. All those areas of the brain are just sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So the more we put in there, the more it forces us to make new connections and it forces us to make new tendrils. I had a friend who was a martial arts instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to say, your body works better the more that you use it. And that's true of the brain. The brain works better the more that you use it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Not to the extent of like, please run it for 24 hours a day. You know, you still have to work within the parameters of the brain. But the more that you think and the more that you read and do all of these things, maybe that's one of the reasons that books have had such a long history with humanity. It's spatial, right? So we're using the same parts of that mapping function in our brain. We read one direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are cultures that read the opposite direction, but there are no cultures that read both directions.
Oh, true. Oh, interesting. Never thought of it that way.
It's just like a map, you know, like here's how I walk on the map. We're using the spatial awareness part of our brain to navigate through the page.
Yeah, sure. I can see that.
You go from left to right, top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
In Hebrew, I think they go from right to left. I think in Japan, they go from right to left as well. I don't know anybody that goes from bottom to top, though.
Yeah, that seems bizarre.
There certainly isn't anyone who goes from middle outward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that means there's a certain necessity to navigate the page, right?
Sure.
And that's why when we built digital things, digital equivalents, like ebooks and computer screens, which are the digital equivalent of paper, we built them to function the same way.
Yeah, they all essentially work the same way. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's interesting, right?
Hmm. Fascinating.
So what also reminded me of is having this dog for a couple of years. I'm always reading things about the dog, like what are good things I can do for the dog. I want to make sure that I'm making him as happy as possible. But one other thing that comes up over and over again, I mean, it must have come up four or five times for me, is one person calls this a smell-fari, which would be safari. I have it written out in my notes, smell-fari, and I'm like, what is that word? Because it looks like smell-ferris.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What is smell-ferris? It took me so long. I'm like, oh, smell-fari. But they say that dogs are happier the more that they use their nose. Mm-hmm. So when you take a dog for a walk, we try to get them to move along. But what mm-hmm. we should be doing is encouraging them to stop and smell as many things as possible. Mm-hmm. This is why I wanted to be able to send you an image, because I'm going to send you an image here that kind of blew my mind. Tell me when you see that.
Whoa.
So what you can see there is the dog, the diagram of the dog. The olfactory bulb is what? How many times would you say? I mean, if you don't use the numbers, just looking at that size difference between the olfactory bulb and the dog and in the human, what would you say the difference is?
I'd guess about 4 times larger.
At least, right?
Yeah.
30 million to 6 million, 50 times larger.
Jeez. Or at the very least, 50 times more sensitive.
Yeah. If we look at the numbers, we don't know if that's all based on size. But clearly, enormous compared to the human size. Mm-hmm. What's also worth pointing out about that is the ratio of that to the size of the brain.
Sure.
Because our brain is considerably larger than the dog's brain. Mm-hmm. So in looking at the olfactory bulb compared to the size of our brain, it's probably 1/30th of the size of the brain.
Wow.
Whereas the dog, probably like 1/7th of the size of that brain.
Yeah, maybe. That's crazy.
It's huge in ratio to the size of their brain.
I mean, it's almost the size of their eyeball.
Yeah, it's about the same size. You're right. Yeah, if I move that just a little bit up, it would look like the dog's eye. Mm-hmm. Here's another image.
That's crazy.
Another thing, this isn't related to what I was going to say, but just insane with the dog thing. Huh. The difference, look where our nose is and look where our olfactory bulb is. Mm-hmm. The dog, it's a straight shot. Mm-hmm. So there's basically shotgunning odor right into that big thing. Where ours is traveling through our sinuses and all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's like a billion filters before it even gets there. Yeah, that makes sense.
So the reason I bring this up, the reason I bring up the dog thing, the smell fari thing, why is the dog happier the more it's using its nose? Because it's such a huge part of the brain that I think, in a way, that smell, mm-hmm. that olfactory bulb, is as important to the dog brain as spatial awareness is to the human brain.
Oh, that makes sense. Sure.
That when we're building spatial maps, they're building olfactory maps.
Mm-hmm. Like a smell universe.
What dogs do with their noses is incredible. You've had dogs. You ever had the dog that knew you were coming home before you got there?
Oh, totally. Sure.
You know, they figured out why that is. Mm. What they figured out was it had something to do with scent. They had this theory. They said, well, maybe what it is at a certain point, the scent of the owner drops to a certain level. And then they know that when it's dropped to that certain level, that dad comes home. Because obviously they can't tell time. I'm going to use numbers here. Obviously the dog's not using numbers. But when dad's smell gets to 20%, that's when he comes home.
Oh, interesting.
So they said, okay, well, can we prove that? So what they did is they had this guy and his dog, and the dog would always know when the dad was coming home. And what they did is in the middle of the day, they bring in a shirt with the dad's fresh smell on it, and the dog had no idea when the dad was coming home anymore.
Oh, man, that's crazy.
It threw his time off completely.
Whoa, that's so weird.
That olfactory bulb in the dog functions mm-hmm. the same way that we build maps and social maps.
That blows my mind more than the images that you sent me. That's crazy.
And people like to downplay, like, oh, you know, dogs, they run on instinct. Like, shit, instinct looks pretty powerful. I'll take some of that instinct.
Yeah, absolutely. That's insane. That's shocking.
But we would be able to do that probably if we had an olfactory bulb that was about 1/7 of the size of our brain.
Yeah, that's true.
And a straight
shot. And I bet if there were two dogs having the same kind of conversation on the podcast, they would be talking about human eyes.
When I take my human for a walk, he's happier.
Yeah, exactly.
The more new neighborhoods I take him in, the happier he is.
And when I tell him to look around and I don't just force him to like move on.
So here's the interesting part of the podcast. What does that mean? Because it seems pretty clear to me. Obviously, it's not 100% true, but not the dog thing, but the human thing. What does it mean? And how can we use this? Hmm. I mean, I thought obviously the first way that we can use this is obviously to keep our brains healthy. But there has to be something more to that. because I think what we could actually look into, not you and I, but I mean as a society, is I think understanding this more, the connection between the human brain and the spatial part of the hippocampus, mm-hmm. that's going to play a huge role in technology, especially when you take into account where some people want us to go right now, which is augmented reality.
Well, I also think that there's an important component of that when we're talking about modern education and how we're all locked into, you know, like I worry about this generation of kids, and now this gives me even a more tangible reason to be worried about this generation of kids because they don't have the amount of stimulus, you know? They don't have the ability, if you're talking specifically in this context, they don't have the ability to create enough rooms.
Right, exactly. That's one of the reasons that we can, in some way, maybe look forward to virtual reality. You know, I've been going through Star Trek Voyager recently and thinking about the holodeck. It seems like a superfluous thing to add to a space exploration ship. But now, in the context of thinking about how it keeps the mind healthy, especially when going through space, when a lot of the days, all you're seeing outside is a blanket of black with little white dots, to be able to go in there and add to your spatial maps. I don't know if Roddenberry thought of that when he created that, but it makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Let's say the holodeck was actually built in such a way that not only, because I feel like there's a component of creation here. I feel like there's a component of creativity or interaction with the environment that is critical to what we're talking about. And I think that if the holodeck was created with the intent of it teaching something, like let's say, for example, the holodeck left out a certain color every time you went in, or a holodeck added more smells and sounds but reduced the amount of visual stimuli, for example, and your brain had to fill in the gaps. And the process of your brain filling in the gaps is what helped you to solidify and create those rooms in your own mind.
I'm curious why you think that creation has to be a part of it.
I feel like it does. I really do.
Where's the creation when I'm walking through a neighborhood or I'm walking through a park?
Well, I feel like there's an imagination component there.
But you don't think that if I was looking at a artificial view of the same exact thing, that my creativity wouldn't work in the same way?
Maybe. Maybe the key is in the difference. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to figure out why that set of stimulus or that component of memory creation is so critical.
Is it because you feel like we need some sort of human agency in this process?
I do. I feel like agency is important. I feel like agency is important in all things. And maybe the aspect of the holodeck that we're talking about, the agency within the holodeck, is almost every single holodeck program we've ever seen on any Star Trek show is a story of some kind where the person plays a different character.
Well, that happens in all of them.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
On Voyager, they go further into a holodeck than they did on the other shows, and they talk about their holo novels. So I think that agency for me doesn't have to be involved, because what I think we're talking about here is physiology, and agency isn't usually involved in our physiology. Like, no matter what I think, it's not going to heal my broken leg.
Well, yeah, but I do. But this is different, right? Like, this is not an internal, or this is not an inward thing fixing something. This is a building of something inside of your own brain. And I feel like, I don't know, here's why I think agency is important, or at least why I think it plays a role. I feel like I was dumb for about 6 years of my life. For lack of a better way of saying it, I didn't travel very much. My job was repetitive. I didn't really strive to do anything creative in that span of time either. And I will say that as difficult, harrowing, and frantic as the last 3 years of my life have been, I feel like I have learned, not just learned a lot, but learned how to learn better and actively seek out opportunities to do so. And I think there's a lot of agency there.
Let's put it this way. I think you and I are, in a way, talking about the same thing on different ends of it. I'm talking about the function of the brain. You're talking about the choice to use the function of the brain.
Okay, I guess I could, yeah.
Like, I'm talking about how does blood pump through our veins?
Yeah, you're talking about the structure, not the furniture. You're talking about the house, not the furniture in the house.
How do we get rid of fat? well, the body says you have to do this, and you're saying we have to choose it, which both of us are right. We're just talking about completely different things.
Sure.
It's interesting that underneath everything is an underlying structure of a map. And the more I think about it, like this, I keep going back to social maps. And I started to realize that there is almost a spatialness to those. Like when you imagine your social maps, do you have any visual component to it at all?
Not that I've been conscious of until this very moment.
Right. It's not something we think about, obviously, because it's an underlying structure. Like, let me give you, this is not a social map, but let me give you a strange example. And I don't know if I'll be able to explain this well, since you can't see me. My mom and I had this conversation once. I don't know how this conversation happened. We were talking about numbers, but we were specifically talking about age. She said, how do you see that in your head? How do you see age in your head? And I knew what she was asking. The way we explained it, we were putting our hands in the air. But like on the far left, there's a column going down. And the column going down starts it up on the top, starts at birth. When you get to the bottom, those are the teenage years. When you hit the teenage years, everything goes at a right degree, a right angle. So now you're going from left to right. And then there's your rest of your teenage years, 20s, your 30s. And then when you get to your 30s, it starts going down again. And then when you get to about 60, it goes to the right again. That is how I see that in my head. Not by choice, but just I've realized that the more when I think about those things, like I'm actually accessing them as a map.
Wow. Interesting.
We've talked about this on a previous episode. I'm not a strong visual thinker. I don't necessarily think of things visually. For a long time, I thought I was a visual thinker because I had these maps. But now it's making me think like, oh, that's not a visual image. That's a map. And for the brain, those are different things.
Now I'm trying to consciously think of how I think.
That's why I found this so fascinating, because it actually makes you think about your thinking. Well, there's one thing to try to understand the grand concepts of how the mind functions, but there's another to try to recognize it in your own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Why are whiteboards and chalkboards and notebooks and Kanban boards and all these things so important to people? Because it allows them to take thought and put it into a map. Why are index cards a great way to organize a novel? Because it allows you to create a map. That's why small screens on computers suck. Because when you really think about it, think about the screen on a computer. When you're looking at the screen of the computer, you're still only reading one, or if you're a good reader, like four words at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So in reality, if you want to read something, you really only need a screen about the size of the palm of your hand. But something about that doesn't work. When you think to do a project, right? Do you grab your phone or do you go, let me go to the device with the bigger screen?
I always go to the bigger screen.
You ever wondered why?
No.
Because we need the space.
Yeah, I guess now, I mean, thinking about it now, that makes logical sense.
That's why on the Mac, the way the windows function is so useful, and why, you know, like so many people are like, well, iOS doesn't compete with getting things done like the Mac does because I can have all these different windows.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it from an actual technical standpoint, having all those windows layered on top of each other shouldn't be any different than having layers that you swipe left and right between. But something about being able to lay those windows out onto the screen and layer them and put them in the places where you want them makes our brain work better. Like, for example, when we do this show, I have one screen on the left side. I always put the Zoom window on the right side. I always put our text message window. Mm. And then on the next screen, I have my browser. And I switch between those two. But those things have to be in those places for me to feel like I have control of what's going on.
Sure. Weird.
It's kind of mind-blowing, right?
Yeah, I'm still like sorting through it in my head, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Well, as I've said before, you know, like I'm the one that's bringing in these things that I've been thinking about. you don't have to come up with grand reactions. You're reacting in the moment. You're the everyman, Lamb.
Weird. I never thought I would be.
In this context, you're the everyman because you're reacting to something that you haven't heard before.
Yeah, but I've never conceptualized my thought in that way before.
It's interesting to think that that is, you know, it's not even a conceptualized, like that is the structure. And then everything else that we've seen it as is the conceptualization.
Well, I remember one of the giant revelations I had while we were doing our podcasts, and this feels like it's the edge of another one, is I remember when I finally came to terms with the fact that I was more introverted than I am extroverted, and having like the actual realization that that is true. And then in this particular context, like maybe I'm not a visual learner.
Right?
Yeah, maybe what I think of as visual is not visual at all in that sense.
Yes, exactly. That's the same realization that I was coming to, where I was like, wait a minute.
That's frustrating.
Because when you think about it, like visual learner, what does that mean? It means that like in order to get it, you have to see it.
Yeah, sure.
But that's not true for me. I read books all the time and I get shit from the books and I don't need pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
Like all the time. The hardest way for me to learn, surprising considering that how many podcasts I listen to, but the hardest way for me to learn is auditory. That's one of the problems I've always had with audiobooks. I get it. I understand what's going on, but I don't feel like I have a handle on it until I can see it on the page. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was like, oh, that I must be visual. But that's not what it is. It's not because it's visual. It's because I need to see it mapped out. How weird is that, right?
That is super weird, dude.
It's not that I have to see the words to understand it, but in order to feel like I'm understanding it, I need to see the words arranged. So it's about the arrangement. It's not about the look.
Yeah. It's about the actual tangible structure of it, not the reading of the word itself.
Yeah.
So it's the word in... It's the word in a structure in which the word can be digested properly.
Yeah, it's like being able to see like
so weird, dude.
Being able to see this paragraph and that one above it and go, oh yeah, these things are related and here's representation of that because they're next to each other.
That's very weird of an idea for me.
It is, but like when you start to actually look at all the things that you do, like for example, your desktop, you arrange things that are similar?
Oh, of course.
It's not because it looks better. It's not because it works better. It's because you have to create a map. You know, like think about actual city maps. Mm-hmm. You don't just throw a house, you know, in a random place. You create residential areas and you create industrial areas. You group similar things together.
Mm-hmm. Sure. City planning and zoning, yeah.
Exactly. That's on my mind because I've been playing this game where I'm building a city, essentially.
Are you playing SimCity?
No, I'm playing Animal Crossing.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So,
but yeah, no, I definitely do that with my computers, by the way. I definitely group like items together. And there's definitely like I can picture. It's funny because now even in thinking about that, like I think about my desktop and now it's not a visual component at all. It could, because if it were visual, then the colors would matter, the depth would matter, all of that would matter. None of that.
The size of the file would matter, yeah, right?
It's the damn placement that matters.
Yeah, top right.
Oh, that's so weird, dude.
And that's why I love the feature. I don't know. I don't remember which version of macOS they added it. But there's a feature where if you throw a bunch of images on your desktop, it automatically stacks them into a stack called images. Mm-hmm. And it automatically stacks all of your screenshots into a stack called screenshots. And same with music and audio files and PDFs. Mm-hmm. I love it.
That's so weird.
Because I don't have to do the work to have all the similar things grouped together. It does it for me.
Yeah.
It puts everything in a nice little fence.
No, I get what you're saying. It's just such a weird idea to me because it really is making me rethink. Like, that's the one thing I really dig about this version of our podcast is that...
Well, this isn't a version. This is a different podcast.
Well, this is a fully different podcast. It's the first podcast or the first thing we've done that makes me actively question the way I do things. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, it's not even actively questioning the way I do things. It's making me question the assumptions that I've made about how I do things.
That's exactly why I bring these things in, because that's what they did to me.
Right? Yeah, that's really weird. That's a very weird idea to me. I mean, it makes a lot of sense now that I'm conceptualizing like how I picture the world. It definitely makes a lot of sense that, you know, if I really think about it, I'm not really a visual learner at all. And perhaps no one really is. And maybe what we think of as being visual is not visual, but structural. And structural, yes, and the structural aspect is far more important.
Structural or spatial, whichever.
Yeah, because honestly, now I'm thinking about my desktop and how I would not give a shit if it was in black and white.
Me neither. I don't care.
I would actually kind of prefer that. It's less distracting.
The only thing that I worry about for the most part with my desktop is window size, placement of things.
Yeah, sure. Window size does matter. Yeah.
And brightness.
Yeah, true. Contrast, more specifically.
Like my note-taking app, I like it in dark mode when it's later. Why? Because the brightness burns my eyes. Has nothing to do with the fact that it's in color.
You know what's funny about that is back when I was using PCs more regularly and I had more time on my hands, I custom made all of my icons.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
It's not that much work. It's and it was a fun design exercise for me, actually. So I would go into Illustrator and I would spend like 2 to 3 minutes making an icon for a folder. And then I would design. So I was basically making freaking symbols for a map, essentially.
Yeah.
Because I would design.
Legend. You were creating a legend.
I was creating a legend. And I would design like elements to have similar icons. Mm-hmm. That's so weird.
Well, you know, just hit me right now. iOS 14.
Mm-hmm.
What's the far right screen on iOS 14 now? It's a map.
Yeah, that's true. Wait, really? Is it?
It throws everything into folders for you.
Let me see that. I've never even looked at that.
I don't have a phone, so I can't do it. But I mean, I have a phone. I don't have an iPhone. But it's the far right screen. I can't remember what it's called.
That's in the latest update?
Yep.
Yeah, I haven't done that update yet.
You might have to. Oh yeah, you might have to turn it on too. It's called the App Library. Here, I'm going to send you an image of it since you don't have it. And I've seen it. Tell me that's not a map of the apps on your phone.
Oh, totally.
And you don't create that. It creates it for you.
What the hell? That's so weird.
So it just takes everything and organizes it for you.
What is the organizational structure?
Suggestions, yeah. And recently added. Obviously, those are pretty straightforward. But then you've got social. So it's all your social stuff. Productivity. Yeah. Okay. So it's, those are categories. So I'm sure that it's just based on categories from an app store. But yeah, then what's very interesting about it is the structure there. Can you see, for example, let's look at the social one there. So in a four app grid, mm-hmm. you've got Facebook full size, Twitter full size, and you got Instagram full size. But yeah. then the other ones in the same space as one of those, you have four apps.
Yep.
So I think what that's doing there is saying these are the three that you use the most in this category.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So in a way, it's creating a map of not only of the structure according to the app store of how things should be grouped, but it's also structuring your usage.
That's so weird.
It's literally saying you're going to want to grab these quick. So it's creating a map for your own usage. But I think in a way that begins to answer the question that I asked you a few minutes ago. What does this mean? What can we do with it? Well, there's part of it. If you understand that people need spatial structures, mm-hmm. you can start building them into sure. things,
mm-hmm.
which is different than building hierarchies. But I think that this is also the reason that certain people like me are drawn to outline structure.
Sure.
Because outline structure, that's why I love the note-taking app that I use, Roam, because it has an outline structure. So I feel like I'm grouping things in the way, you know, when you indent something, you're saying this belongs to that. That's a map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So the more you start looking to it, everything that we use is a map in some way. Keyboard. What's keyboard? It's a map.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I just realized a couple days ago that I can touch type. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and not only that, but when you're doing touch type, and it's funny because my brain went to touch type immediately. You're not looking at the keyboard. The point is to not look at the keyboard. The point is to know the structure well enough that you don't need it.
Yeah, you have the map memorized.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, that's so weird.
And there's different kinds of maps. You got QWERTY. You have Dvorak.
You know what's really funny about that, though? Like, now that we're throwing it into this context, man, I've never made that correlation in my entire life, which is very bizarre. So, it's not coincidental, then, that I have a good long-term memory, and I also have a phenomenal sense of direction.
Mm-hmm. Because they're directly related.
That's so weird. I never thought of it that way.
Think about people who get lost all the time. They're kind of absent-minded, aren't they?
Yeah, I never get lost. I never get lost, man. When I used to travel a lot for work, like I would literally just need to drive the city one time and I would know the whole city.
I'm the same way. I can be like, oh yeah, I've been there once. Don't forget to turn at that tree.
Exactly. Exactly. I would know where the restaurants were. If I'd seen it, I would know where it was. Like, that's so weird. Why I never thought of it that way.
That reminds me of one of the key takeaways from Bond's book, actually. One of his main questions is our use of GPS damaging the way that our brain functions? Because mm-hmm. we're not using, you know, like what we talked about with atrophied, our muscles will atrophy if you don't use them. Will our spatial awareness, will it be damaged from not using it enough? And it seems clear when we talk about solitary confinement that that's true, I think.
Sure.
So what he suggests, or one of the people he interviews suggests, I don't remember which, that you start to build that understanding into the way that you use things. So for example, one of the problems with GPS is that we're no longer mapping it in our mind. It becomes an abstraction instead. Mm-hmm. Looking at the screen becomes an abstraction. So we're not actually using that part of our brain. So what you can do is if you go somewhere new, say you're going to a new restaurant you've never been to. Obviously, we're talking about in the future, 2021, when we can all go to restaurants again.
Yeah, sure.
Park a mile away from it and use your GPS to navigate yourself to walk there, you know, the 10-minute walk or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when you leave, don't use your phone to get back to your car.
Yeah, just walk back, sure.
Find your way back to the car using your brain.
Oh, that's so weird.
So I think that's what's interesting about it too. Not only what can we do with this, but then also what ways can we make sure that our behavior keeps this part of our brain healthy? Mm-hmm. And I think that's why when I used to go for walks, I was always drawn to going a different way. Like, oh, I walked down this street and took a right and then went around this block yesterday. I'm going to go left today. And then the next day, I'm going to go straight. I'm going to go up half a mile instead. I think that was like a subconscious part of my brain craving that.
It's funny that you say that because I think I still actively do that while I'm driving around.
I hate going the same way. Just like, yeah, I hate, like, ordering the same thing off a menu.
Totally. Like, it's funny. You would think that I would take the same way to work as I take home. I don't. I actually go two different routes. I mean, and on the rare occasion, like, I'll take random different routes too, just for the sake of it.
I'm not obviously not saying that everybody craves this, because I know people that literally like to go the same exact way, that rely on that comfort. But what's interesting about that is those people also, the few people that I can think of that like to do that, are also very closed-minded people. Mm. Very interesting how it all relates together, right? Yeah. It makes you start to wonder, like, what is another function of the city? Another function of the city is that in some way that it feeds the brain in a different way. In some ways, I'm sure not all good ways, of course. There's something about living in a small town and going to the same store every time that's very beautiful. But I wonder if you're depriving the spatial awareness in your brain of something that it needs.
Mm, sure.
And maybe that's why people like to go on vacations, you know? Like, okay, I've been in this town for like 6 months. I need something new.
Yeah, and I mean, now that I think about it, like, there's definitely a correlation between closed-mindedness and a willingness to adventure.
Think about vacation. Everybody's like, why do people take vacation? To relax. Mm-hmm. Nobody relaxes on vacation.
No, I don't relax on vacation.
Nobody does. They go and they do things. They go snorkeling. They do things that are more active than they normally do.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I occasionally do relax when I travel, but I think that's more a function of how much I travel compared to most people.
Right. But what I'm saying is, like, it's not the main function of vacation.
Yeah. Of course.
The way that we say it is.
Yeah, sure.
Because it's quite clear. Like, if vacation was really just about resting, mm-hmm. you wouldn't leave home.
Yeah, you would just sleep in your bed.
What's the most relaxing place to be? In your home, where all your stuff is.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Instead, we go somewhere that we've either never been before or that's just different. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it really isn't about resting. It's about a change.
That's very weird of an idea.
It's really cool to see it all through this lens. I think that...
Yeah, it's really messing with me, man, because now this is one of those things that makes me realize two things, right? Like, the first thing, obviously, is how wrong I've been thinking about how my natural functions work within the scope of the... And just how I think of activities and everything else. But the bigger thing that's interesting in all of this to me is that how many of those things I gravitated to purely based on assumptions or societal expectation.
We all do it. I mean, even what I just said right there about vacation, we all say it's for rest and relaxation. Mm-hmm. Why? Because that's what everybody says. We never actually sat and thought about it.
That's actually true, yeah.
not no one, but most people don't sit around and go, you know what? Instead of watching this new episode of my favorite sitcom, I'm going to sit here and ponder why we go on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
That's why these conversations are useful to me, because it gives me a space to do that.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, I think that we've gone pretty far on this one.
But I feel like we're just getting started on this. There's so much more to this.
Yeah, we're stretching it into pointing out maps everywhere, which means that we've reached the usefulness of this conversation. We can always talk about it more after you have time to absorb it.